Part 3. Durin's Folk. Concerning the beginning of the dwarves, strange tales are told, both by the Eldar and by the dwarves themselves. But since these things lie far back beyond our days, little is said of them here. Durin is the name that the dwarves used for the eldest of the seven fathers of their race, and the ancestor of all the kings of the Longbeards. He slept alone, until in the deeps of time, and the awakening of that people, he came to Azan-ul-Zebar, and in the caves above Khaled-Zaram, in the east of the Misty Mountains, he made his dwelling, where afterwards were the mines of Moria, renowned in song. There he lived so long that he was known far and wide as Durin the Deathless. Yet in the end he died before the elder days had passed, and his tomb was in Khazad-dûm, but his line never failed, and 5 times an heir was born in his house, so like to his forefather that he received the name of Durin. He was indeed held by the dwarves to be the deathless that returned, for they have many strange tales and beliefs concerning themselves and their fate in the world. After the end of the First Age, the power and wealth of Khazad-dûm was much increased, for it was enriched by many people and much lore and craft, when the ancient cities of Nogrod and Belagost in the Blue Mountains were ruined at the breaking of Thangorodrim. The power of Moria endured throughout the Dark Years, and the dominion of Sauron, for though Eregion was destroyed and the gates of Moria were shut, the halls of Khazad-dûm were too deep and strong, and filled with a people too numerous and valiant, for Sauron to conquer from without. Thus its wealth remained long unravished, though its people began to dwindle. It came to pass that in the middle of the Third Age, Durin was again its king, being the sixth of that name. The power of Sauron, servant of Morgoth, was then again growing in the world, though the shadow in the forest that looked towards Moria was not yet known for what it was. All evil things were stirring. The dwarves delved deep at that time, seeking beneath Barazinbar for Mithril, the metal beyond price that was becoming yearly ever harder to win. Thus they roused from sleep a thing of terror that, flying from Thangorodrim, had lain hidden at the foundations of the earth since the coming of the host of the West, a Balrog of Morgoth. Or perhaps they released it from prison. It may well be that it had already been awakened by the malice of Sauron. Durin was slain by it, and the year after, Nine the First, his son. And then the glory of Moria passed, and its people were destroyed or fled far away. Most of those that escaped made their way into the north, and Thrain the First, Nine's son, came to Erebor, the lonely mountain, near the eastern eaves of Mirkwood, and there he began new works, and became king under the mountain. In Erebor he found the great jewel, the Arkenstone, heart of the mountain. But Thorin the First, his son, removed and went into the far north to the grey mountains, where most of Durin's folk were now gathering, for those mountains were rich and little explored. But there were dragons in the wastes beyond, and after many years they became strong again and multiplied, and they made war on the dwarves and plundered their works. At last Dain the First, together with Fror, his second son, was slain at the doors of his hall by a great cold drake. Not long after most of Durin's folk abandoned the Grey Mountains, Gror, Dain's son, went away with many followers to the Iron Hills, but Thror, Dain's heir, with Borin, his father's brother, and the remainder of the people, returned to Erebor. To the great hall of Thrain, Thror brought back the Arkenstone, and he and his folk prospered and became rich, and they had the friendship of all men that dwelt near. For they made not only things of wonder and beauty, but weapons and armour of great worth, and there was great traffic of ore between them and their kin in the Iron Hills. Thus the Northmen, who lived between Kelduin, River Running, and Carnen, Red Water, became strong and drove back all enemies from the east. And the dwarves lived in plenty, and there was feasting and song in the halls of Erebor. So the rumour of the wealth of Erebor spread abroad and reached the ears of the dragons. And at last Smaug the Golden, greatest of the dragons of his day, arose and without warning came against King Thror and descended on the mountain in flames. It was not long before all that realm was destroyed, and the town of Dale nearby was ruined and deserted. But Smaug entered into the great hall and lay there upon a bed of gold. From the sack and the burning many of Thror's kin escaped. And last of all from the halls by a secret door came Thror himself and his son Thrine the Second. They went away south, into long and homeless wandering, with their family, among whom were the children of Thrine the Second, Thorin Oakenshield, Freyrin, and Dis. Thorin was then a youngster in the reckoning of the dwarves. With them went also a small company of their kinsmen and faithful followers. It was afterwards learned that more of the folk under the mountain had escaped than was at first hoped, but most of these went to the Iron Hills. Years afterwards, Thror, now old, poor, and desperate, gave to his son Thrine the one great treasure he still possessed, the last of the Seven Rings, and then he went away with one old companion only, called Nar. Of the ring he said to Thrine at their parting,
"This may prove the foundation of new fortune for you yet, though that seems unlikely, but it needs gold to breed gold. Surely you do not think of returning to Erebor?" said Thrine.
"Not at my age," said Thror. "Our vengeance on Smaug I bequeath to you and your sons, but I'm tired of poverty and the scorn of men. I go to see what I can find."
He did not say where. He was a little crazed, perhaps, with age and misfortune, and long brooding on the splendour of Moria in his forefathers' days, or the ring, it may be, was turned to evil now that its master was awake, driving him to folly and destruction. From Dunland, where he was then dwelling, he went north with Nar, and they crossed the Redhorn Pass, and came down into Azanulzebar. When Thror came to Moria, the gate was open. Nar begged him to beware, but he took no heed of him, and walked proudly in as an heir that returns. But he did not come back. Nar stayed nearby for many days in hiding. One day he heard a loud shout and the blare of a horn, and a body was flung out on the steps. Fearing that it was Thror, he began to creep near. But there came a voice from within the gate.
"Come on, beardling, we can see you, but there's no need to be afraid today. We need you as a messenger."
Then Nar came up, and found that it was indeed the body of Thror, but the head was severed and lay face downwards. As he knelt there, he heard orc laughter in the shadows, and the voice said,
"If beggars will not wait at the door, but sneak in to try thieving, that's what we do to them. If any of your people poke their foul beards in here again, they will fare the same. Go and tell them so. But if his family wish to know who is now king here, the name is written on his face. I wrote it. I killed him. I am the master."
Then Nar turned the head, and saw, branded on the brow in dwarf runes, so that he could read it, the name Azog. That name was branded in his heart, and in the hearts of all the dwarves afterwards. Nar stooped to take the head, but the voice of Azog said,
"Drop it. Be off. Here's your fee, beggar beard."
A small bag struck him. It held a few coins of little worth. Weeping, Na fled down the silver load, but he looked back once and saw that orcs had come from the gate and were hacking up the body and flinging the pieces to the black crows. Such was the tale that Na brought back to Thrine, and when he had wept and torn his beard, he fell silent. 7 days he sat and said no word. Then he stood up and said,
"This cannot be borne."
That was the beginning of the war of the dwarves and the orcs, which was long and deadly, and fought for the most part in deep places beneath the earth. Thrine at once sent messengers bearing the tale north, east, and west, but it was 3 years before the dwarves had mustered their strength. Durin's folk gathered all their host, and they were joined by great forces sent from the houses of the other fathers. For this dishonour to the heir of the eldest of their race filled them with wrath. When all was ready, they assailed and sacked, one by one, all the strongholds of the orcs that they could, from Gundabad to the Gladden. Both sides were pitiless, and there was death and cruel deeds by dark and by light. But the dwarves had the victory through their strength, and their matchless weapons, and the fire of their anger, as they hunted for Azog in every den under mountain. At last all the orcs that fled before them were gathered in Moria, and the dwarf host, in pursuit, came to Azanulbizar. That was a great vale that lay between the arms of the mountains about the lake of Haledzaram, and had been of old part of the kingdom of Hazard-Dûm. When the dwarves saw the gate of their ancient mansions upon the hillside, they sent up a great shout like thunder in the valley. But a great host of foes was arrayed on the slopes above them, and out of the gates poured a multitude of orcs that had been held back by Azog for the last need. At first fortune was against the dwarves, for it was a dark day of winter without sun, and the orcs did not waver, and they outnumbered their enemies, and had the higher ground. So began the battle of Azanulbizar, or Nandohirion in the Elvish tongue, at the memory of which the orcs still shudder and the dwarves weep. The first assault of the vanguard, led by Thrine, was thrown back with loss, and Thrine was driven into a wood of great trees that then still grew not far from Kaledzaram. There Freyrin his son fell, and Fundin his kinsman, and many others, and both Thrine and Thorin were wounded. Elsewhere the battle swayed to and fro with great slaughter, until at last the people of the Iron Hills turned the day. Coming late and fresh to the field, the mailed warriors of Nine, Gror's son, drove through the orcs to the very threshold of Moria, crying, "Azog! Azog!" as they hewed down with their mattocks all who stood in their way. It is said that Thorin's shield was cloven, and he cast it away, and he hewed off with his axe a branch of an oak, and held it in his left hand to ward off the strokes of his foes, or to wield as a club. In this way he got his name. Then Nine stood before the gate, and cried with a great voice,
"Azog, if you are in, come out, or is the play in the valley too rough?"
Thereupon Azog came forth, and he was a great orc with a huge iron-clad head, and yet agile and strong. With him came many like him, the fighters of his guard, and as they engaged Nine's company, he turned to Nine and said,
"What? Yet another beggar at my doors? Must I brand you too?"
With that he rushed at Nine, and they fought. But Nine was half blind with rage, and also very weary with battle, whereas Azog was fresh and fell, and full of guile. Soon Nine made a great stroke with all his strength that remained, but Azog darted aside and kicked Nine's leg, so that the mattock splintered on the stone where he had stood. But Nine stumbled forward. Then Azog, with a swift swing, hewed his neck. His mail collar withstood the edge, but so heavy was the blow that Nine's neck was broken and he fell. Then Azog laughed, and he lifted up his head to let forth a great yell of triumph, but the cry died in his throat. For he saw that all his host in the valley was in a rout, and the dwarves went this way and that, slaying as they would. and those that could escape from them were flying south, shrieking as they ran, and hard by all the soldiers of his guard lay dead. He turned and fled backwards towards the gate. Up the steps after him leapt a dwarf with a red axe. It was Dain Ironfoot, Nine's son. Right before the doors he caught Azog, and there he slew him and hewed off his head. That was held a great feat, for Dain was then only a stripling in the reckoning of the dwarves. But long life and many battles lay before him, until old but unbowed he fell at last in the War of the Ring. Yet hardy and full of wrath as he was, it is said that when he came down from the gate he looked grey in the face, as one who has felt great fear. When at last the battle was won, the dwarves that were left gathered in Azanulbizar. They took the head of Azog, and thrust into its mouth the purse of small money, and then they set it on a stake. But no feast nor song was there that night, for their dead were beyond the count of grief. Barely half of their number, it is said, could still stand or had hope of healing. Nonetheless, in the morning Thrain stood before them. He had one eye blinded beyond cure, and he was halt with a leg wound, but he said,
"Good! We have won the victory. Khazad Dûm is ours."
But they answered, "Durin's heir you may be, but even with one eye you should see clearer. We fought this war for vengeance, and vengeance we have taken, but it is not sweet. If this is victory, then our hands are too small to hold it." And those who were not of Durin's folk said also, "Khazad Dûm was not our father's house. What is it to us, unless a hope of treasure? But now, if we must go without the rewards and the weir-guilds that are owed to us, the sooner we return to our own lands, the better pleased we shall be." Then Thrain turned to Dain and said,
"But surely my own kin will not desert me."
"No," said Dain, "you are the father of our folk, and we have bled for you, and will again. But we will not enter Khazad Dûm. You will not enter Khazad Dûm. Only I have looked through the shadow of the gate. Beyond the shadow, it waits for you still, Durin's bane. The world must change, and some other power than ours must come before Durin's folk walk again in Moria." So it was that after Azanulbizar the dwarves dispersed again. But first with great labour they stripped all their dead, so that orcs should not come and win there a store of weapons and mail. It is said that every dwarf that went from that battlefield was bowed under a heavy burden. Then they built many pyres and burned all the bodies of their kin. There was a great felling of trees in the valley, which remained bare ever after, and the reek of the burning was seen in Lorien. Such dealings with their dead seemed grievous to the dwarves, for it was against their use. But to make such tombs as they were accustomed to build, since they will lay their dead only in stone, not in earth, would have taken many years. To fire, therefore, they turned, rather than leave their kin to beast or bird or carrion orc. But those who fell in Azanulbizar were honoured in memory, and to this day a dwarf will say proudly of one of his sires, "He was a burned dwarf, and that is enough." When the dreadful fires were in ashes, the allies went away to their own countries, and Dain Ironfoot led his father's people back to the Iron Hills. Then, standing by the great stake, Thrain said to Thorin Oakenshield,
"Some would think this head dearly bought. At least we have given our kingdom for it. Will you come with me back to the anvil, or will you beg your bread at proud doors?" "To the anvil," answered Thorin. "The hammer will at least keep the arms strong until they can wield sharper tools again."
So Thrain and Thorin, with what remained of their following, among whom were Balin and Gloin, returned to Dunland, and soon afterwards they removed and wandered in Eriador, until at last they made a home in exile in the east of Ered Luin, beyond the Lûn. Of iron were most of the things that they forged in those days, but they prospered after a fashion, and their numbers slowly increased. They had very few womenfolk. Dis, Thrain's daughter, was there,
She was the mother of Fili and Kili, who were born in the Ered Luin. Thorin had no wife. But, as Thror had said, the ring needed gold to breed gold, and of that, or any other precious metal, they had little or none. Of this ring, something may be said here. It was believed by the dwarves of Durin's folk to be the first of the seven that was forged, and they say that it was given to the king of Khazad-dûm, Durin the Third, by the elven smiths themselves, and not by Sauron, though doubtless his evil power was on it, since he had aided in the forging of all the seven. But the possessors of the ring did not display it or speak of it, and they seldom surrendered it until near their death, so that others did not know for certain where it was bestowed. Some thought that it had remained in Khazad-dûm, in the secret tombs of the kings, if they had not been discovered and plundered. But among the kindred of Durin's heir it was believed, wrongly, that Thror had worn it when he rashly returned there. What then had become of it, they did not know. It was not found on the body of Azog. Nonetheless, it may well be, as the dwarves now believe, that Sauron, by his arts, had discovered who had this ring, the last to remain free, and that the singular misfortunes of the heirs of Durin were largely due to his malice, for the dwarves had proved untamable by this means. The only power over them that the rings wielded was to inflame their hearts with a greed of gold and precious things, so that if they lacked them, all other good things seemed profitless, and they were filled with wrath and desire for vengeance on all who deprived them. But they were made from their beginning of a kind to resist most steadfastly any domination. Though they could be slain or broken, they could not be reduced to shadows enslaved to another will, and for the same reason their lives were not affected by any ring, to live either longer or shorter because of it. All the more did Sauron hate the possessors and desire to dispossess them. It was therefore, perhaps, partly by the malice of the ring, that Thrain, after some years, became restless and discontented. The lust for gold was ever in his mind. At last, when he could endure it no longer, he turned his thoughts to Erebor, and resolved to go back there. He said nothing to Thorin of what was in his heart, but with Balin and Dwalin and a few others, he arose and said farewell and departed. Little is known of what happened to him afterwards. It would now seem that as soon as he was abroad with few companions, he was hunted by the emissaries of Sauron. Wolves pursued him, orcs waylaid him, evil birds shadowed his path, and the more he strove to go north, the more misfortunes opposed him. There came a dark night when he and his companions were wandering in the land beyond Anduin, and they were driven by a black rain to take shelter under the eaves of Mirkwood. In the morning he was gone from the camp, and his companions called him in vain. They searched for him many days, until at last, giving up hope, they departed and came at length back to Thorin. Only long after was it learned that Thrain had been taken alive and brought to the pits of Dol Guldur. There he was tormented and the ring taken from him, and there at last he died. So Thorin Oakenshield became the heir of Durin, but an heir without hope. When Thrain was lost he was 95, a great dwarf of proud bearing, but he seemed content to remain in Eriador. There he laboured long, and trafficked, and gained such wealth as he could, and his people were increased by many of the wandering folk of Durin, who heard of his dwelling in the west and came to him. Now they had fair halls in the mountains, and store of goods, and their days did not seem so hard, though in their songs they spoke ever of the lonely mountain far away. The years lengthened. The embers in the heart of Thorin grew hot again, as he brooded on the wrongs of his house and the vengeance upon the dragon that he had inherited. He thought of weapons and armies and alliances as his great hammer rang in his forge, but the armies were dispersed and the alliances broken, and the axes of his people were few, and a great anger without hope burned him as he smote the red iron on the anvil. But at last there came about, by chance, a meeting between Gandalf and Thorin that changed all the fortunes of the House of Durin, and led to other and greater ends beside. On a time, Thorin, returning west from a journey, stayed at Bree for the night. There Gandalf was also. He was on his way to the Shire, which he had not visited for some 20 years. He was weary, and thought to rest there for a while. Among many cares he was troubled in mind by the perilous state of the North, because he knew then already that Sauron was plotting war, and intended, as soon as he felt strong enough, to attack Rivendell, but to resist any attempt from the east to regain the lands of Angmar and the northern passes in the mountains. There were now only the dwarves of the Iron Hills, and beyond them lay the desolation of the dragon. The dragon Sauron might use with terrible effect. How then could the end of Smaug be achieved? It was even as Gandalf sat and pondered this that Thorin stood before him and said,
"Master Gandalf, I know you only by sight, but now I should be glad to speak with you, for you have often come into my thoughts of late, as if I were bidden to seek you. Indeed, I should have done so if I had known where to find you."
Gandalf looked at him in wonder.
"That is strange, Thorin Oakenshield," he said, "for I have thought of you also, and though I am on my way to the Shire, it was in my mind that is the way also to your halls."
"Call them so, if you will," said Thorin. "They are only poor lodgings in exile, but you would be welcome there if you would come, for they say that you are wise, and know more than any other of what goes on in the world, and I have much on my mind, and would be glad of your counsel."
"I will come," said Gandalf, "for I guess that we share one trouble at least. The dragon of Erebor is on my mind, and I do not think that he will be forgotten by the grandson of Thror."
The story is told elsewhere of what came of that meeting, of the strange plan that Gandalf made for the help of Thorin, and how Thorin and his companions set out from the Shire on the quest of the lonely mountain that came to great ends unforeseen. Here only those things are recalled that directly concern Durin's folk. The dragon was slain by Bard of Esgaroth, but there was battle in Dale, for the orcs came down upon Erebor as soon as they heard of the return of the dwarves, and they were led by Bolg, son of that Azog whom Dain slew in his youth. In that first battle of Dale, Thorin Oakenshield was mortally wounded, and he died and was laid in a tomb under the mountain with the Arkenstone upon his breast. There fell also Fili and Keeli, his sister's sons, but Dain Ironfoot, his cousin, who came from the Iron Hills to his aid, and was also his rightful heir, became then King Dain the Second, and the kingdom under the mountain was restored, even as Gandalf had desired. Dain proved a great and wise king, and the dwarves prospered and grew strong again in his day. In the late summer of that same year, 2941, Gandalf had at last prevailed upon Saruman and the White Council to attack Dol Guldur, and Sauron retreated and went to Mordor, there to be secure, as he thought, from all his enemies. So it was that when the war came at last, the main assault was turned southwards. Yet even so, with his far-stretched right hand, Sauron might have done great evil in the north, if King Dain and King Brand had not stood in his path. Even as Gandalf said afterwards to Frodo and Gimli, when they dwelt together for a time in Minas Tirith. Not long before news had come to Gondor of events far away.
"I grieved at the fall of Thorin," said Gandalf, "and now we hear that Dain has fallen, fighting in Dale again, even while we fought here. I should call that a heavy loss, if it was not a wonder, rather, that in his great age he could still wield his axe as mightily as they say that he did, standing over the body of King Brand before the gate of Erebor until the darkness fell. Yet things might have gone far otherwise and far worse. When you think of the great battle of the Pelennor, do not forget the battles in Dale and the valour of Durin's folk. Think of what might have been. Dragonfire and savage swords in Eriador,
knight in Rivendell. There might be no queen in Gondor. We might now hope to return from the victory here only to ruin and ash. But that has been averted, because I met Thorin Oakenshield one evening on the edge of Spring and Bree. A chance meeting, as we say in Middle-earth.
Dis was the daughter of Thrain the Second. She is the only dwarf woman named in these histories. It was said by Gimli that there are few dwarf women, probably no more than a third of the whole people. They seldom walk abroad except at great need. They are in voice and appearance, and in garb if they must go on a journey, so like to the dwarf men that the eyes and ears of other peoples cannot tell them apart. This has given rise to the foolish opinion among men that there are no dwarf women, and that the dwarves grow out of stone. It is because of the fewness of women among them that the kind of the dwarves increases slowly, and is in peril when they have no secure dwellings, for dwarves take only one wife or husband each in their lives, and are jealous, as in all matters of their rights. The number of dwarf men that marry is actually less than one-third. For not all the women take husbands. Some desire none. Some desire one that they cannot get, and so will have no other. As for the men, very many also do not desire marriage, being engrossed in their crafts. Gimli Glóin's son is renowned, for he was one of the nine walkers that set out with the ring, and he remained in the company of King Elessar throughout the war. He was named Elfrend, because of the great love that grew between him and Legolas, son of King Thranduil, and because of his reverence for the Lady Galadriel. After the fall of Sauron, Gimli brought south a part of the dwarf folk of Erebor, and he became lord of the Glittering Caves. He and his people did great works in Gondor and Rohan. For Minas Tirith they forged gates of mithril and steel to replace those broken by the Witch-King. Legolas, his friend, also brought some elves out of Greenwood, and they dwelt in Ithilien, and it became once again the fairest country in all the Westlands. But when King Elessar gave up his life, Legolas followed at last the desire of his heart and sailed over sea. Here follows one of the last notes in the Red Book. We have heard tell that Legolas took Gimli, Glóin's son, with him because of their great friendship, greater than any that has been between elf and dwarf. If this is true, then it is strange indeed that a dwarf should be willing to leave Middle-earth for any love, or that the Eldar should receive him, or that the lords of the West should permit it. But it is said that Gimli went also out of desire to see again the beauty of Galadriel, and it may be that she, being mighty among the Eldar, obtained this grace for him. More cannot be said of this matter.